This is Words First, an ongoing exploration of the librettist's craft. I am always fascinated by the many hats that librettists wear. It's rare that I meet a librettist who has only written theatrical works for their entire career, and I think these twists and turns of life experience are what gives some of our best librettists their material. Deborah Brevoort is no exception. Before she was writing plays, musicals, and operas, she worked in politics in Alaska, and she tells me that her experience there colors everything that she does. After her bout in politics, she moved into theater. As her website bio says, she is an alumna of New Dramatists, one of the original company members of Alaska's Perseverance Theater, a member of the Playwrights Collective at Florida Studio Theater, and a co-founder of Theater Without Borders, dedicated to international theater exchange. Her turn into opera came when she was chosen to be in the first cohort of American Lyric Theater's Composer Librettist Development Program. Since then, in addition to writing award-winning plays and musicals, she has written 10 operas. We discuss a fair number of them and concentrate quite a bit on Steal a Pencil for Me, The Knock, and her upcoming Quamino's Map. Here is my conversation with Deborah Brevoort from January 26th. Deborah, welcome to Words First. I'm so happy to be speaking with you today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you are first and foremost a playwright. Can you tell me how the writing bug caught you, and did it happen before or after you found theater?
Oh, the writing bug caught me when I was 14 years old, when I read Edna St. Vincent Millay's poetry, My Candle Burns at Both Ends, It Will Not Last the Night. And I thought, oh, I'm going to be a poet. So I was in, 14, I guess I was high school, early high school. Yeah. And I started writing all that bad high school poetry that one writes when one's 14. Yep. But I just knew right then and there that I was going to be a writer. I've also been a reader from a very young age. My mother used to feed me books that were way beyond my years. Mm-hmm. Starting at the age of seven, really, I was reading adult books. And it was my mom was a one of these suburban housewives in the 1950s and 60s who was an avid reader and didn't have anybody to really talk to because the other housewives were not avid readers. And so she fed me those books. And I think that's how so I began reading at a very young age. Yeah. And I read a lot. And then I realized I wanted to be a writer and thought it was poetry, not. Then I thought, oh, I'm going to write a novel, not. And it wasn't until I got to Alaska and I actually abandoned my writing desires. I thought, oh, this is like the most impractical thing. And so I actually went into politics. I was a policy person in Alaskan government. Got involved with a group of people starting a theater company in Juneau, Alaska, which is the Perseverance Theater. Today is like the State Theater of Alaska. We were the founders of that and started writing and realized that I was a playwright. So anyway, I discovered I was a writer pretty late. I became part of a group that was founding this theater company and I was the producer and I did everything. I was an actor, I was a stage manager, everybody did everything. We were up in Alaska in a remote location and then I began to write and I did it. I began to write very late. I had been running this theater company, a member of this company for 15 years. Yeah. So I did everything backwards. I then went to graduate school and I, at Brown to do playwriting with Paula Vogel. Mm-hmm. And from there I transitioned to musical theater writing at NYU. And then just 10, 12 years ago, made the leap to opera.
Yeah. So yeah, I noticed on your website that the first opera libretto listed is a new translation you did of De Fledermaus for Anchorage Opera. Was that your first? Is that how you fell into the opera world or were there things before that?
I fell into the opera world when ALT announced that they were going to do the composer librettist development studio. Uh-huh. And so I was in the very first cohort of that program. And so I did that training, and then I ALT commissioned me to write Embedded with Patrick Saluri. They had a grant for the Poe Project. So that was my first opera. And then after, and then my next opera was the commission from the Anchorage Opera to take Fledermaus and adapt it to contemporary Alaskan culture. They needed somebody, they needed an Alaskan who had opera training who could make a contemporary Fledermaus. And because I worked in Alaska politics for many years, I knew where all the bodies were buried. Yeah. So. And there were a lot of scandals. We had FBI raids of our state capitol while I was there because of corruption. It was, the story of Fledermaus completely translated to this situation. It was unbelievable. I mean, so, and then that, and that was when Alaska reality TV programs sort of took off. So instead of having the ballet audition in Act Two, I just made it a reality TV show audition.
Nice.
And made a contemporary. So the Fledermaus was my second project. And then they had me redo Mozart's Impresario. That was my third.
You're from Alaska. So that seems, I mean, not from, but you lived there for quite a while. And that seems so, it seems so exotic and far away, actually, when I think about it. But how much does your time in Alaska, just thinking about writing Fledermaus, how much does your time in Alaska play into your writing overall? Does it come up a lot, or was that a one-off experience?
Alaska actually informs everything that I write,
really?
Whether I'm writing about Alaska directly or not. And the reason for that is that the arts, I lived there for many years and I went back and forth for many years. I go back, I try to get back every year. I identify as an Alaskan. My deepest ties are there. Community is the community. Your participation in the community has a very different quality in Alaska than it does anyplace else. Mm-hmm. People are really dependent on each other. You live in these small, isolated communities. You know everybody. Mm-hmm. You participate in community affairs in a way you don't, or I don't, here in New Jersey and New York. And the arts occupy a really important place in every community. In part because of the isolation. So there's a huge, vibrant arts community. And I guess what that means is that if you're to be successful in Alaska, or if you are to do the arts, opera, theater, whatever, you need to reach, it's a small community, and you kind of need to reach everybody so that the work tends to be much more accessible, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a place to go do, you know, sort of really arcane experimental stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not to say that you have to pander and, you know, and do, you know, what is popular, but there is a populist aspect to it.
Sure.
And that populist aspect, I think, is the thing that I carry in my heart, because I'm really not interested in talking to 10 knowing people in a downtown garage. Mm-hmm. Although as a theater lover, I will go to those downtown garages and really enjoy the work there. But my work is always aimed at reaching as big an audience as possible, at speaking to all segments of the community instead of just one, or, you know, the sort of elite community that likes, you know, obscure things in the arts. I'm very Catholic, or maybe promiscuous would be a better word in my taste. I like it all and I draw on it all, but I'm always trying to speak to everybody. Uh-huh. My model for this is Shakespeare, because that's what Shakespeare did. You know, every play's got a love scene. Every play's got a sword fight for those who just want love scenes, sword fights, and clown acts, right?
Yeah.
Every Shakespeare play has that. You know, the queen is also in the audience, and you need to have the high level stuff as well. And so that aesthetic informs everything that I write.
Did you find that learning how to write a libretto or writing a libretto played into the way that you already wrote? Or do you find that you have to change the way you look at writing when you're writing a libretto versus writing a play?
Yeah, there's a big... obviously, there's a lot of similarities. Sure. I think successful librettos are built on all the dramatic principles of playwriting. And so I bring that character action, activated dialogue, all that stuff you do in a play, mm-hmm. a really good opera libretto will do. I don't think an opera libretto is just poetic. It's that you have story, you have plot, you have character, you have all that stuff. But you have an economy mm-hmm. In libretto writing. And as a playwright, your dialogue is where you're doing everything. You're in the driver's seat. Your every word is active. You're driving the action through the dialogue. This is true for musicals as well. Mm-hmm. The book writer and the lyricist is really the one in the driver's seat, using language to accomplish all of that. And music in a musical assists.
Right.
But in an opera, it's different. Mm-hmm. You are creating an architecture or a skeleton or a structure that enables a large-scale musical composition to occur, and that composition is in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm. So it's yes, there are sometimes scenes where in an opera where the words are leading, and you don't want to be too absolute about this because. Sure. There's a lot of back and forth, but so it just required a much greater economy, mm-hmm. And it required a greater architectural mindset when you're designing the story mm-hmm. that leaves the space for the music to do what the music needs to do in an opera, which plays a bigger role than it does in a musical. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does,
but that. That was the paradigm shift that I had to make mm-hmm. when I was learning, and Michael Corey was one of my teachers. And there was this defining moment where I finally got it. I was taking embedded to him. He was the artistic advisor for ALT to supervise this team and their first opera. And he kept saying, it's a musical. It's a musical. It's not an opera. And he'd send me back home and I'd write again. And I'd bring the libretto back in and he goes, it's still a musical. Finally, he said, stop working so hard. Mm. You are not supposed to do everything. Stop working so hard. And there was something in the way he said that just went big, and I got it. And
sometimes it's just that one little statement that just all of a sudden everything clicks in your brain.
It clicks, right. And I think I was primed for it because I was doing lyric writing, and that's economy. You know, a song is not a song in a musical, it's a scene.
Right.
It has a dramatic action, So once I learned lyric writing in musical theater, it was and that took a while for me. It was a much easier step to opera.
Do you enjoy the collaborative aspect of writing opera?
Oh, I love the collaborative aspect. Yeah. Yeah. I am a firm believer that two heads are better than one, especially if you have two good heads working on something, right? And you're all sort of, pulling in the same direction. I love the collaboration. Yeah.
How do you generally work with a composer, or does it change depending on who you're working with?
It really changes because everybody has their quirks and their own working methods. There are some composers I work with who don't collaborate a lot. We've done successful collaborations. I have to say, I don't prefer that. I can mm-hmm. do that. I can pass off my libretto and then sit and wait. I prefer not to do that.
Sure.
But I've had very successful collaborations with people who prefer to work that way.
Sure.
I have another collaboration where, I actually just sit at, this is more in musicals, not in operas, where I have a composer who, does not want me to set anything, basically wants me to sort of like sketch four pages of, it's sort of like vomiting on a page, really. It's like there's no shape to it. And then he sifts through and he wants me there as he comes up with a musical idea. And we both jump on that and then we shape it in the moment, right? I have another collaborator. I'm working with Shauna Pebbelo right now on an opera, and my husband will roll over at 1 o'clock in the morning, like, who are you texting with at this hour? And like, Sean, he got an idea, you know, and we're, you know, when we're back and forth all the time. So, you know, and I prefer that, that way of working best, but, you know, you have to be, everybody's different. You have to be flexible and meet everybody with their own process.
Yeah. So last time you were on Words First was about a year ago, maybe a little more, when you appeared with Matt Barresi and several other librettists for the Decameron Opera Coalition's first endeavor, which was Tales from a Safe Distance. And you were talking about your work with Michael Ching, Dinner for Three, about basically about an unfulfilled couple coming to a major understanding about their needs. So I want to talk about some of your other works, actually, since that's the one we actually discussed. So can you talk to me about Steal a Pencil for Me, which made its debut at Opera Colorado and was composed by Gerald Cohen?
Sure.
This is based on a true story, yes?
Oh, yes, yes. Steal a Pencil for Me started as... a book. It's a collection of love letters that were written by Ina and Jaap Pollock, who were Dutch Jews who were sent to Westerbork and then to Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. Mm-hmm. And they fell in love in the concentration camp and sent these letters back and forth to each other and survived the Holocaust and ended up getting married and immigrated to the United States. And they were members of Gerald's synagogue, where he is a cantor. Mm-hmm. A really beautiful documentary was made of this. You can see it on PBS. They show it almost every Yom Kippur. It's on Netflix. Jaap was 99 years old, and Gerald said to him, "You know, I really want to write an opera," and he said, "Well, you better hurry up." And the synagogue commissioned us to write it for his 100th birthday.
Oh my gosh.
And so it was like, you know, hubba hubba time. So I said to Jaap, I said, "Do you have any advice for me?" He said, "Yeah, hurry." But anyway, it's a beautiful story. And it's about these two people. Jaap was married at the time. Ina was engaged to somebody else. Her fiance and it was murdered by the Nazis, but she didn't know it at the time. And she's falling in love with this guy. And they would meet every day behind the barracks and sort of imagine what their life would be like. And that was how they kept themselves alive. Mm-hmm. And then they wrote these love letters. And, so it's a Holocaust story with a happy ending, or as happy an ending as you could have.
Right.
It's a beautiful story. We based it on the letters, and we based the opera on many hours of conversation with the two of them and the stories that they told us about their lives and how things unfolded. And
what's it like adapting letters? Do you like the adaptation process that way?
Well, maybe adaptation isn't like really the proper word for it. The letters inspired it. They had beautiful ways of saying things. And so I use the letters as sort of material that I excavated in telling the story about how they survived. Mm-hmm. The opera basically followed their real story, which, you know, was awful, the way that they were rounded up, the way that, you know, how they survived. And it's really a, you know, one of those beautiful stories about the triumph of the spirit and how one keeps one's spirit alive during these, you know, horrific events.
Yeah. Yeah. How many times has it been done?
It's only been, we did it at the synagogue for his birthday. Uh-huh. Did it at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan, who also helped commission it. And then it was done at Opera Colorado.
Right.
And it's going to be, a cast album is going to be recorded this summer.
Oh, congratulations. So, that's wonderful.
We've only had that one production. Or that we had two workshoppy productions and then the full production in Colorado.
So let's talk about The Knock. This is music by Alexandra Vrbolov.
Vrbolov,
Yeah, and commissioned by Glimmerglass Festival last year. And I did get to see it, by the way. It was great to actually watch it. I'm so glad I had the opportunity. What kind of research did you have to do to write this piece?
Well, I did a lot of research, and this actually is an outgrowth of a theater project. I had been commissioned by the Virginia Stage Company in Norfolk back during the surge of Iraq to write a play about military wives. At the time, there were a lot of plays that were coming out about returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. And then we had the surge where it all sort of was just like 2012. The military community was a difficult community to get into. They're very insular, but with the help of some military wives, I was basically embedded in the Norfolk community. Our 1 year project actually took 3 years in order for me to create the relationships that I needed to get the real stories. Mm-hmm. And I made lifelong friends who continue to this day from that project. But during that period, I was hanging out on bases, going to homecomings. I was in the chat groups online, which is where many of the wives live, really. I interviewed 43 spouses from every rank, every branch of the armed services, every geographical region, every cultural group. I mean, I just had a real diversity and did extensive research as well as interviews and just hanging out. And the knock is, it's a military expression. Everybody knows what the knock is. Everybody lives in fear of the knock. Mm-hmm. And I heard lots of stories about the knock. Mm-hmm. And the story in the opera is it's a fictionalized version of one of the stories that was particularly powerful. Mm-hmm. I wrote a play. There's a knock scene in the play. It's not the knock scene of this. But this story that was told to me that the opera is based on was just one of those stories that haunted me. I could not forget it. I could not forget the woman who told it to me, who in telling the story completely sobbed and broke down in a California pizza kitchen in Virginia Beach. And I just remember meeting her and holding her as she told me this story. Wow. It was burned in my heart. And I just kept thinking, this is an opera. So I sat down and sort of wrote out the treatment and what it would be about the person who has to deliver the knock, and the way women are gathered when there's these awful events, but they don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. The military gets them all together to try to contain the communications and, you know.
Right.
And I thought, well, this, if there's ever an operatic moment, an operatic story, it's this about the extreme emotions that everybody is experiencing while they're and the uncertainty, which is mm-hmm. highly dramatic. Mm-hmm. And then of course the moment when the knock is delivered, which is horrible. Right. So I basically, you know, sat down and developed this. I thought I knew what this was. I knew how it would work. And then it became the question of who can I write this with? And Alexandra and I had done our training together in the ALT program. We were both in the first cohort. We had been teamed together to write our final projects. And we had a terrific, we just clicked, you know, it was. And so I called her up and took her out to coffee. And I said, I have this idea and here it is. And she just started crying in Starbucks. And she said, yes, unbeknownst to me, her grandparents are the national heroes of Serbia. They were, they worked in the resistance against Hitler. They were both executed by the Nazis. And today they are considered national heroes because they helped save a lot of people in Serbia during World War II. So she actually comes from a family who's made the ultimate sacrifice.
Right. Right.
And so she knows what that looks like and what that feels like. I didn't know this about her.
Yeah.
So it ended up being just a beautiful collaboration, and I love what she did with it. And we just were like in sync on this from the minute I told her the story, and it just, and then Francesca, you know, commissioned it, and it's intended for the stage.
Right. Yeah. But like so many things in the during the pandemic, yeah. It just, you know, it's...
It was like a fast pivot to a film format. We were like, oh my God, you know? And now that it's a film, I look at the film and I'm thinking, in a funny way, maybe this is what it was destined to be all along, you know? Because it works beautifully as a film. It's going to have its stage premiere in 2023 at Cincinnati Opera.
Oh,
so
terrific.
We're going to get
there. That's wonderful. Yeah.
And they co-commissioned it. So it's going to be, we're going to get the stage version too.
That's
so
great. So you'll get to see it on both sides. That's really wonderful. I want to ask just from the story side of things. So as I said, I just watched it online and I was struck with how you wrote the army officer who is tasked with delivering the bad news. He's reluctant to do it, though he knows that it's an order, he must do it. The intensity with which he talks to himself throughout it is really heart pumping. And so I'm just curious, how did you talk to people who have delivered the knock before, or how did you get into the head of this military officer?
Yeah, I did not speak to anybody who had to deliver the knock. But there was a really beautiful memoir that was written called The Final Salute about the Marine. It was the Marine officer who served a Western region. And in fact, the stage opera is set in the West. And about this guy whose job is to drive all over Colorado and Wyoming delivering the knock.
Right.
And so that was a big source of inspiration. And then there are a lot of memoirs that have been written by military wives and folks in the military about this situation. So I read a lot of those to sort of get a sense of it. But then ultimately it was, you know, like anything that you write, research can only take you so far.
Sure.
You have to inhabit it. You have to inhabit it emotionally. And I had to sort of put myself, I'm like, what, you know, especially if it's the first knock, what does that feel like? And what does it feel like if you're, you know, gung-ho to be over there with your buddies and then you're given this horrible job to sort of sit in your apartment in the United States, which a bunch of them are, and to have to go and do this. And so, it's, you know, a combination of all of those inspirations and then just putting myself in that situation about what would I do if I was in that position.
It's really powerful that every time we go to him, we think about the grief of the mother. We don't think about the grief that must soak into somebody who has to do that on a regular basis. I want to circle back to something you were talking about just within the commission and within you writing it. And I'm just curious, how often do you have the initial idea and how often is an idea brought to you in terms of when you're writing an opera?
Let me see. I've got 10 operas. Four of them have come to me and the others I have originated. For example, Embedded, which is, you know, we were given Poe.
Right.
Edgar Allan Poe. Here's the complete works, you know, the encyclopedic works. But in terms of what to do with that, do something about Poe, then the embedded story and the translation to the contemporary situation was mine. The knock was mine. I have written a libretto. We are looking for commission with Patrick Slurry of Albert Nobbs. That was mine. Quamino's Map, that is
upcoming
at Chicago Opera Theater. Basically, Lydia commissioned me and Erilyn and said, come up with something. We threw around a lot of ideas, and the story there is basically my invention, inspired by multiple conversations, not totally mine. But I do originate more. I originate a lot.
Yeah, sounds like it, but it sounds like differently, like with different impetus.
That's right.
Each one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Murasaki's Moon. It was, you know, hey, the Tale of Genji exhibit at the Met. We need 50 minutes. It has to be based on the Tale of Genji, Lady Murasaki's diary. You have, you know, 2 months, go. Well,
that's a pretty specific brief. So,
so it's both. But in the case of the knock, even Francesca said, I've never had this happen where a librettist came to me and pitched me and I gave a commission based on a librettist, you know.
Well, congratulations to you then. Proposal. That's pretty great.
Yeah. And she said, well, wait, before I approve this, who are you writing? And then she, you know, listened to Alexander's music. So, oh my God, of course. But yeah, no, I initiate a lot. And what I do a lot, the other thing I've noticed is that very often opera companies don't give librettists a long time to write their librettos. And we need to have a larger community conversation about that.
Yes, this has come up a number of times, by the way.
Yeah.
I think this is a very interesting thing that we should be talking about.
Yeah. And they seem to think that we can whip out a libretto in, like, you know, 6 weeks. I mean, it's just impossible. And but the truth is that the commissions come up very quickly and they want you to deliver the libretto quickly. So what I do is I am always developing proposals. I've got a file where I get an idea for an opera and I develop it enough that I can, you know, that I leave room, obviously, for my collaborator, but I get the main concept figured out so that when I get the phone call, hey, we want to commission you, have any ideas? I've got 3 to 4 weeks ahead. And if one of my ideas, you know what I mean? That's how I've solved that problem. So I am always jumping ahead. I've got a file down here of projects that I'm ready to jump on when somebody calls. And I've cut out a month of work by developing them on my own. And so obviously some of these end up going nowhere, but I feel like that's just that's how I do it. Otherwise, I don't know what I would do with these deadlines.
Let's go back to Quamino's Map.
Quamino's Map.
Quamino's Map. Erlen Wallen is the composer, and this is your upcoming work at Chicago Opera Theater. Can you you sort of hinted at the story? Can you tell us a little bit more about this piece?
Yeah, this piece is about two little known facets of history. The first is that during the American Revolutionary War, a substantial number of enslaved people fought for the British against the Americans in exchange for their freedom. Mm-hmm. So we know that there's an app that documented at least 20,000, but historians who were just beginning to look at this believe there were up to 100,000 slaves who fought for the Brits.
Wow.
When the Brits lost, they then dispatched those folks to Nova Scotia, to Sierra Leone, to the Caribbean, and to London. And so there was a large influx of formerly enslaved people who landed in London after the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. And this story picks up that, this opera picks up that story at the arrival in London.
Uh-huh.
Also at the time, there was a class of the gentry. There were black gentry members in England. They were, you know, aristocratic Africans living in London. And again, this is another segment of society that most people don't know about. And so Quamino's Map is about the intersection of those two communities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there was a book that Erlen had, a novel that sort of was written about this chapter in history about the American slaves arriving in England, that sort of gave us the idea for Quamino's Map. We did not adapt the novel or use the novel. Mm-hmm. Completely different story, but it was the thing that alerted us to this chapter of history that we thought was really compelling. So that's what it is. That's about a young man who arrives in London. And of course, you know, the Brits didn't give them the promised pensions, you know, they just sort of dumped them in London.
Shocking.
And you were surprised, right? And they're like, hey, you're free. And it's like, but what about the pension you promised? What about the what? And they were given a couple pence a day for, you know, heel of bread. And anyway, so that it follows that story and that intersection with those two communities.
Very interesting. When do we get to see this piece, and how is it? Is it coming out as live theater, or is it being filmed?
Yeah. Well, knock on wood, as of today, I mean, you know, it's going to open in at the end of April.
Terrific.
So we go into rehearsals in March, and it's, you know, lovely, nice size, have a nice big chorus, and brilliant. We've workshopped it, and April and first weekend in May.
That's great. It's coming up.
Yeah.
What else, or is there anything else that's coming up for you in the nearish future, either as a playwright or librettist? Actually, what's on your map right now?
Yeah, well, I have a play called My Lord, What a Night, which mm-hmm. Which just closed at the Ford's Theater in DC, mm-hmm. And it's been being optioned for the West End and Broadway. So I am in the process of that, which is very exciting. And and I have a new commission, which I can't really speak on yet because we're in negotiations, but I have a new commission this time for a musical.
Oh, wow.
And I write musicals also, but then of course getting the Knock to the stage in Cincinnati, getting Quamino.
That's a big deal. That's wonderful.
Yeah, and then getting My Lord, What a Night mounted in London, and then hopefully New York. So that's sort of on my plate for the next year. And then writing this musical. The musical will be about the loving story.
Oh, great!
I can say that. I can't say who's commissioning yet, but. It's going to be the loving story, which led to the landmark Supreme Court decision about interracial marriage. So
it's wonderful. You're busy. So, congratulations on that.
Great.
Deborah, thank you so much. This has been such a huge pleasure. I'm happy to talk to you.
Well, thanks for your interest, and it's great talking to you.
Thank you to Deborah Brevoort for a fun chat. After 2 years of making very little opera due to COVID, I am back with a full traveling schedule. Because of that, I can't guarantee that these interviews will come out as regularly as they once did. Even this one was a week late due to my work in Phoenix on a little night music. So I'm about to head out to Denver for a Carmen, but stay tuned in the next few weeks for a conversation with Eric Einhorn about his libretto writing and how he works with traditional rep libretti in new ways with his company On Site Opera. Thank you for listening. I'm Keturah Stickan. Words First is recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. It is produced and edited entirely by me, but I couldn't have put it together without the help of some pretty great people. Thank you to Eileen Downey for The Gift of Mozart, Chloe Doucet for a hand-painted logo, and my husband Matt for his constant support. Thank you also to Buzzsprout, who hosts me and makes sure you can access my content on nearly every platform podcasts are available. Questions or comments? Head over to my website at keturahstickan.com, hosted by the good people at Unison Media.